with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Tiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council unanimously calls for the U.S. to pull out of Iraq.
A federal court judge rules that a ban on road construction in national forests applies to hundreds of oil and gas leases sold by the Bush administration.
U.S. soldiers from rural communities are dying at a higher rate in Iraq and Afghanistan than urban natives.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,888 officially acknowledged deaths of U.S. soldiers. An additional 147 U.S. contractor deaths bring the total U.S. deaths in Iraq to 3,035. A recent report by The Lancet places the Iraqi civilian death count at more than 650,000.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 1st, 2006. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Annalisa Hummel. A federal judge has ruled that a Clinton-era ban on road construction in national forest area also applies to hundreds of oil and gas leases sold by the Bush administration. The ruling means the holders of more than 300 leases that permit oil and gas exploration cannot build roads to access those areas. 20 environmental groups and four states, Oregon, Washington, California, and New Mexico, had sued the Forest Service over changes made by the Bush administration. The changes required governors to petition the federal government to protect national forest roadless areas in their states. Liam?
Fabric softener that spilled from an envelope in a mailroom at Snake River Correctional Institution touched off a brief anthrax scare yesterday. A three-person hazardous material team was sent in, and state police officers sealed the entrance to the administration building. The Oregon State Police said there was no credible threat related to the incident and no indication a crime occurred, but the police would investigate it. Prison officials says the hazmat team left in mid-afternoon after 5 hours. Visiting was postponed and the afternoon mail delayed, but otherwise prison operations were not interrupted.
A man convicted of killing a Seattle police officer will be retried on an aggravated murder charge that could lock him away for life. Quinton Irvin had been convicted of second-degree murder for the 1994 shooting of Antonio Terry. That conviction was thrown out 2 years ago when a state Supreme Court ruled that murder charges don't apply if someone didn't intend for the victim to die. The Washington Supreme Court ruled yesterday that it's not double jeopardy to retry Irvin on the aggravated murder charge.
A longtime employee of the King County Prosecutor's Office was arrested this week in an internet sting in Seattle and accused of trying to arrange sex with a 13-year-old girl. 54-year-old Larry Corrigan was jailed Wednesday for investigation of attempted rape of a child and released yesterday without bail. Corrigan was the director of financial operations for the prosecutor's office from 1979 until early last year. The case will be handled by the state attorney general's office to avoid any possible conflict of interest, officials said. Corrigan is accused of emailing pornography to an undercover detective posing as the girl. Police said he arranged to meet the girl at a video store. Officers arrested him when he showed up.
The U.S. Army is in the early stages of establishing a new striker brigade at Fort Lewis, Washington. The completion of the new brigade will realize the Army's goal of creating 7 combat teams. 2 other striker brigades are based at Fort Lewis. The 4 others are in Alaska, Hawaii, Pennsylvania, and Germany, respectively. Currently, the 3rd Brigade is on its second year-long tour in Iraq. The 4th Brigade is training at Fort Lewis as it prepares for an Iraq deployment next year. Once the 5th Brigade is in place, Fort Lewis's active duty population will top 31,000.
Oregon peace and justice activists are celebrating today after the city council unanimously passed a resolution calling on the U.S. to get out of Iraq now. KABU reporter Martha Odom was there and spoke with Lisa Loving about the session.
Lisa, it was an extraordinary event, not because we've solved the war, though we've taken another step toward it, but it was a full house. At least 60 people had signed up to testify, and there was an extraordinary range of testimony. Everyone was represented, families of people who are deployed in Iraq gave tearful testimony. There was facts, there was figures on the cost of the war. There were teachers, there were students. Labor was there, folks who work for housing, education. There's a representative from Sisters of the Road, Oregon Wildlife Federation. There were veterans, an assortment of veterans. The spectrum of people who were testifying was wonderful, and to be in the company of people who have worked so hard for peace, who have worked continuously, and that we won. Not the war, but the battle, at least.
What did the city commissioners say? I mean, they must have spoken. What did they say?
Dan Salzman reluctantly voted aye. Randy Leonard, we must give him great points. He has had a change of heart. He originally rejected the idea of city council doing this sort of resolution, and he not only led the effort to bring the resolution this time, but in testimony he referred to the Iraq invasion as a terrible tragedy. The other commissioners all expressed dismay, rage, grief over the Iraq invasion, and were very happy to support this resolution. They also repeatedly thanked us for our long work, our peace activities, which was interesting because Bonnie Tinker testified and appreciated the support for the peace community, but she mentioned being arrested at the October 5th World Can't Wait protest along with her son, and looked at the mayor and said, paraphrasing, please remind your police that the next time they're shooting tear gas and rubber bullets at us, that it's us they're shooting at.
Bonnie Tinker being a very beloved community activist with Love Makes a Family. We are already kind of running out of time. One of the things that strikes me about the timeliness of this initiative that was passed by the city council is it comes on the heel of actually Governor Ted Kulongoski coming out and saying, yep, I just went to Iraq, it's worse, and we need to pull out now, which is actually radical in the context of the Democratic Party style politics. So what do you what's your take on that?
It is radical, and that was his answer. After having been there. Two of the people testifying are state representatives. One, Diane Rosenbaum, pledged to work harder, that this resolution was good, but it's only a first step. And Representative Chip Shields has vowed that he will introduce legislation in the state Congress to do a similar resolution for the state of Oregon. It was exciting. It's kind of like the election, you know. It's not really a victory, but it's one of those little things that gives you faith to keep on doing what you're doing.
Thanks, Martha. We've been speaking with KABU reporter Martha Odom, and I'm Lisa Loving, KABU Evening News.
Italy pulled the last of its troops from Iraq today, and South Korea announced this week that it will pull half of its troops from the country. Meanwhile, at least 2,888 U.S. military personnel have died in Iraq since the start of the war. A new report released by the Carsey Institute, a think tank at the University of New Hampshire, indicates U.S. soldiers from rural communities are dying at a higher rate in Iraq and Afghanistan than soldiers from larger metropolitan areas. Aaron Glantz has more.
According to the Carsey Institute, 825 of the first 3,095 Americans killed in Iraq and Afghanistan came from rural America. That's 27% of the casualties, even though rural areas account for only 19% of the U.S. population. Soldiers from rural Vermont have the highest death rate in the nation, followed by Delaware, South Dakota, and Arizona. The data hardly surprises Arizona native Alden Rossbrook, the founder of an environmental group supporting the 11,000-acre Santan Mountain Regional Park southeast of Phoenix, has been spending much of his time on a memorial named after Nathan Martins, a Navy corpsman who died last September when the Humvee he was riding in rolled. He had been in Iraq for only 10 days. He was 20 years old.
Nathan Martins was a corpsman, served with the 6th Marine Division in Iraq in Anbar Province, lived within 2 miles of the park, and he did a lot of horseback riding, trail biking and hiking before he went into the Navy. And we felt that it should be in a public location, and we thought that that was probably best suited for this Arizona Memorial.
Hundreds of area veterans joined friends and family for the memorial's unveiling Veterans Day weekend. 85 small aluminum plaques with names of Arizona's fallen soldiers sit below a 70-foot flagpole. Dee Davis, president of the Kentucky-based Center for Rural Strategies, says the Iraq War is increasingly hitting home in America's heartland.
This year we did polling around the election, polling of rural voters in contested congressional races, and the thing we saw was that 75% of the rural voters knew somebody who had been to Iraq or Afghanistan, that in small towns and rural communities, the war is not an abstraction, it's real. You have a visceral feel for what the war means. So many first responders are also members of the Guard.
William O'Hare, co-author of the Carsey Foundation report, believes a sagging rural economy is the main reason the American countryside has a higher death rate in Iraq and Afghanistan.
For example, the decline in manufacturing in this country over the last 5 or 6 years in the post-2000 economy has hit rural America harder than urban America. A lot of people don't know that a higher proportion of the rural workforce is in manufacturing than the urban workforce. And so as good manufacturing jobs have declined over the last 5 or 6 years, that means there's fewer good opportunities for good jobs for young people from rural America. And in that context, not only manufacturing, but agriculture and timber and lots of other industries, in the context of decreasing good job opportunities, the military looks more favorable to those young people from rural America.
On Monday, the Pentagon announced the name of the 86th Arizona soldier killed abroad since September 11, 2001. The military said 19-year-old Army Private Reese Moreno of Prescott, Arizona, died of injuries suffered in a non-combat-related incident in Balad, Iraq, November 24th. Rossbrook said Moreno's name will be added to the memorial in the Santan Mountains.
It's very sad but necessary. We have room for about 20 more names, and we hope we don't have to use that space. But we will continue to do so. We feel it's our duty.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
The U.S. Supreme Court will hear two cases next week that are challenging school integration for grades K through 12. In both cases, the petitioners will argue that it's unconstitutional for race to be the deciding factor in placing youth in schools. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Crystal Meredith wanted her kid Joshua McDonald to attend Bloom Elementary School in Jefferson County, Kentucky. Joshua was denied admittance because he was white. Bloom Elementary already met the racial quotas. Not more than 50% and not less than 15% of students can be black. Crystal Meredith calls this unconstitutional. On Monday, the Supreme Court will hear her case, along with a similar case involving the Seattle public school system. In Seattle, race is the second most important factor in determining school placement. The decision could have broad sweeping significance in public schools' integration policy. In 2003, the Supreme Court ruled that the University of Michigan cannot use race as a main criteria in their admissions. The petitioners cite the University of Michigan case, saying racial preference is unacceptable for public schools. They say it's unconstitutional. Harold Johnson is an attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation.
That kind of racial classification just doesn't jibe with the Constitution and the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. And that's why we're hopeful that the U.S. Supreme Court will send a message that outlaws this kind of racial discrimination in public schools.
Those supporting the plaintiffs include the Board of Education and Paul Clement, the Solicitor General of the United States. They also say forced racial integration policies strip some students of equal rights under the 14th Amendment. The respondents in the case are the respective school districts. They claim racial integration plans provide a beneficial schooling environment for all students and more competitive and equal schools. Respondents and their supporters presented to the court in written statements numerous studies that show the benefits of school integration. Gary Orfield is co-founder of the Civil Rights Project at Harvard University.
If this decision were to come down in a very sweeping form, it could mean that the only integration that would be legal in the country would be that which happens by accident.
They say voluntary integration of schools is unpredictable and detrimental to youth and society. Schools use several ways for integration: magnet schools, school assignment policies, or how they draw district lines. There is no documentation on how many school districts around the country use race policies, but Angelo Anchetta, assistant professor of law at Santa Clara University, says race standards have been decreasing in recent years.
The courts are basically backing off desegregation plans. We're seeing a lot of school districts dissolving court orders or settlement agreements where they were employing desegregation measures. Those are no longer under court order. And what you see in a place like Louisville, which is employing a voluntary plan but was under court order, is an attempt to try to maintain what they accomplished over 25 years. And unfortunately, what you see in a lot of other districts is an abandonment of these kinds of policies. And the unfortunate consequence where you see this abandonment is that the schools are resegregating. They're becoming more segregated than they were even 20, 30 years ago.
But plaintiffs say possibly hundreds of school districts employ some sort of race policy, which they say means possibly millions of students aren't given their school preference because of integration standards. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
And now, at 18 minutes after 5, daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
We're Americans, so we like to be number one, right? Not only do we like to be, we expect to be. And since we are, by gollies, the land of the free, it's a given that in all things liberty-ish, we are numero uno in the world, right? After all, we're America, we're the richest, we're the best, we're the freest, we're number 53? Yes, the watchdog group Reporters Without Borders has just released its 2006 Worldwide Press Freedom Index, ranking nations on their record of government censorship, threats, intimidation, jailings, or physical reprisals against journalists. Our good old U.S. of A. did not make the top 10, top 25, or even the top 50. Holy founding fathers! The U.S. is tied with Botswana, Croatia, and Tonga for 53rd. Okay, you might expect those goody-two-shoes countries like Finland and Iceland to rank above us, but Estonia, Slovenia, Namibia, El Salvador, Serbia, the Dominican Republic? Sheesh. I suppose we have to be proud that we do rank ahead of Turkmenistan, where the government tortured a journalist to death last year. The trend here is not good. In last year's index, America ranked 44th in press freedoms, and in 2002, our country was 17th. Reporters Without Borders cite our government's imprisoning of several journalists and the Bushites' imperious efforts to intimidate reporters who criticize them as reasons for America's continuing slide down the freedom scale. Cheney has yet to shoot a reporter, but hey, they've still got 2 years left, so maybe we haven't even bottomed out. This is Jim Hightower saying, for a nation that enshrines freedom of the press in the very first provision of our Bill of Rights, chanting, "We're number 53, is humiliating. By the way, check out Iraq, where Bush has poured precious American blood and treasure into his Operation Enduring Freedom. It ranks 154th in press freedom, 15th from the bottom.
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30. Followed by Bread and Roses at 6, and then at 7 o'clock, it's Jay's Place with J.J. Johnson. Tonight's weather, Portland should be partly cloudy with lows around 30 degrees, and tonight the Columbia Gorge will be mostly cloudy with lows in the high 20s. Tomorrow's weather should be mostly sunny with highs in the mid-40s in Portland and the upper 30s in the Gorge. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Canada's Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper introduced a controversial motion to Parliament this week to recognize Quebec as a nation within a united Canada. FSRN's Stéphane Christophe reports from Montreal.
Political debate in Canada concerning Quebec's national identity stretches back decades. Popular support within Quebec for separation from Canada remains significant today, with the separatist party, Parti Québécois, expected to win in the upcoming provincial elections. Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper's symbolic parliamentary motion to recognize Quebec as a nation was passed by the House of Commons this week.
Our position is clear. Do the Québécois form a nation within Canada? The answer is yes. Do the Québécois form an independent nation? The answer is no. And the answer will always be no.
Recent polls suggest the majority of Canadians don't support the parliamentary motion. Alexander Trudeau is a journalist and son of former Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, responsible for the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
At best, it's meaningless. And if it is meaningful, then it's built walls within our freedom, especially Quebecois. Who is entitled to be part of this nation, and what does it mean? I don't think it's necessary, I don't think it's useful, and I think at worst it's kind of dangerous to start defining collective entitlements and rights based on one kind of nationalism or another.
The Assembly of First Nations in Canada has denounced the Conservative motion to recognize Quebec as a nation, as reflecting a double standard in regards to federal policy concerning Indigenous people. Multiple Indigenous nations continue to thrive within Canada's borders, who view a recognition of their nationhood as essential. Nazila Batash of No One Is Illegal, Montreal.
There is some recognition that needs to be there, that there is a distinct entity in the nation of Quebec, that there is a history of struggle of the Quebecois people against the English in Canada, and that this history needs to be recognized by Canada. But I think recognizing that without putting it in the broader context of the other nations of this country, and more particularly the Indigenous nations of this country, would be, again, completely hypocritical and would be applying a double standard to the history of this region.
The right of Quebec's self-determination as a separate entity from Canada is a central question to Quebec politics. In a province which has seen support for the Conservative government of Canada drop to record lows due to Canada's pro-war policies concerning Lebanon and Palestine, Raymond Legault is a well-known Quebecois anti-war activist.
In its statement, it says we recognize Quebec as a nation within a united Canada, which is not a recognition of Quebec as a nation which has a right to determine itself. Bottom line is, if the population of Quebec decides to separate from Canada, that this be agreed to. Period.
This is Stéphane Christophe reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Montreal.
The International Labour Organization says almost 3.5 million people of working age were killed by AIDS last year. In a report released for World AIDS Day, they say the virus is having a devastating effect on the workforce of many countries. They called for worldwide action to improve access to HIV treatments to cut mortality rates.
Mexico witnessed two separate inaugural ceremonies today in order to secure the presidential transition of powers. Tim Russo reports.
In an unprecedented act, Mexico's president-elect Felipe Calderón received for the first of two times the presidential sash from outgoing President Vicente Fox at 12:01 a.m. in the presidential palace. Calderón's second and official inauguration, as defined by the Mexican Constitution, took place this morning in Mexico's Congress, despite attempts by opposition parties to block the swearing-in ceremony. President Felipe Calderón and Vicente Fox had to force their way to the podium after a massive entourage of Secret Servicemen facilitated their entrance into congressional chambers. The ceremony lasted less than 5 minutes amidst shouts, whistles, and chanting from congressional representatives. Legislators had already spent 3 days camped out in the halls of Congress after opponents and supporters of Calderón scuffled earlier this week over control of the podium where the swearing-in took place. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands protested in the streets of Mexico City today, still upset that their votes in the hotly contested presidential election were never recounted. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Tim Russo in Mexico.
In the Mexican state of Oaxaca, two men suspected of killing New York indie media videographer Brad Will have been released from police custody. Photographic evidence shows the two men, both local police officials in plain clothes, aiming firearms at demonstrators on October 27th, shortly before Will was shot to death. The judge who ordered their release cited lack of evidence.
Hundreds of thousands gathered in downtown Beirut today to call for the removal of the pro-Western government. Jackson Ellers report.
Today, as Shia Muslim supporters of Hezbollah and their Christian allies in the Free Patriotic Movement gathered in downtown Beirut, the mood was a marked contrast from the hundreds of thousands of people that gathered the week before to show their support for the current pro-Western government and to mourn for the assassinated industry minister Pierre Gemayel. Many observers at today's demonstration described it in less somber terms, more as a celebration of what is shaping to be a confrontation between the two political camps in Lebanon. Chanting for the replacement of the government, many interviewed said that they could not trust a government that failed to protect their own, referring to the Gemayel assassination the week before. Meanwhile, Hezbollah and the opposition supporters plan to maintain a continuous presence outside of the parliament building until the government steps down. Current government has said that it has no intention of resigning. Reporting from Beirut, Lebanon, this is Jackson Ellers for Free Speech Radio News.
Pope Benedict XVI joined senior Muslim clerics in prayers at the Blue Mosque in Istanbul, Turkey. It's the second time in history that a pope has visited a Muslim place of worship. The move is being seen as a gesture to mend relations with the Muslim community. Many Muslims were outraged in September when the Pope made a speech linking violence and the Prophet Muhammad.
African and South American leaders have announced the formation of a partnership aimed at ending the dominance of Western economies. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
The partnership, known as the Africa-South America Cooperative Forum, was formed at the end of the first summit of African and South American leaders, which took place this week in Nigeria. The aim of the partnership is to promote economic ties between both continents in order to end Western dominance of the global economy. President Olusegun Obasanjo, who hosted the summit, said an economic cooperation between countries of both continents is necessary to counter decades of economic and political vices like the reliance on high interest loans from financial institutions backed by developed countries. The leaders resolved to set up institutions and mechanisms to give practical expression to the new cooperative forum. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Thailand and the U.S. are installing the Indian Ocean's first tsunami detection buoy. The buoy is being laid between Thailand and Sri Lanka, two of the country's worst hit by the 2004 tsunami, which killed more than 200,000 people. It's the first of a planned network of 24 buoys to be laid along the fault line where the 2004 earthquake occurred. The U.S. and Thailand will share the cost of the device.
At least 146 people in the Philippines have been killed by a mudslide triggered by Typhoon Durian, and at least 75 others are still missing across Albay province. Two villages southeast of Manila were buried and five others affected. Durian is the fourth typhoon to hit the Philippines in 4 months. Nearly 200 people were killed by Typhoon Xiangxiane in September. That's the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 1st, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. That goes for news tips as well. Call us with your news tips at 503-231-8032. 8032 extension 203. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kbu.fm. Our producer and audio editor tonight is Lisa Loving, our assistant producer and wire editor Ross Egan. Special thanks to reporter Martha Odom, and our engineer is Brian Averill. The KBU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Annelisa Hummel. If we can recognize that change and uncertainty are basic principles, we can greet the future with the understanding that we do not know enough to be pessimistic.
Coming up Monday morning on KBU at 7, hear the KBU Morning News. At 7:30, Cecil and Celeste host More Talk Radio. At 9 on the Old Mole Variety Hour, the moles dig among the hidden roots of polite society, exposing the foundations of wealth and power. At 10 on Health Watch, naturopath Dr. David Naiman interviews Randall Neustetter, author of The Child Health Guide, about holistic pediatrics for parents. At 10:30, it's Monday on the Environment with Scott Forrester. And at 11, Democracy Now!
Good night, Liam.
Good night, Annalisa.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, as reports from Iraq become increasingly dire, U.S. policymakers and their media enablers are looking everywhere but at themselves for someone to blame. Nation columnist and New York correspondent for London's Guardian newspaper, Gary Young, writes about the finger-pointing in his latest Guardian column, "They Lied Their Way Into Iraq, Now They Are Trying to Lie Their Way Out." We'll hear from him. Also on Counterspin today, politicians and pundits tend to agree that solving the Israel-Palestine conflict would go a long way towards achieving peace in the broader Middle East. But that's about where the agreement ends. A new book by activist and frequent Counterspin guest Ali Abunima suggests a new path, one that's almost never discussed in the mainstream media. Ali Abunima spoke with Counterspin's Peter Hart about his new book, One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
In a November 24th Washington Post column, Charles Krauthammer recycled a deceptively edited quote by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez that made Chavez appear to be voicing an anti-Semitic slur. Krauthammer began the column by chiding actor Sacha Baron Cohen and his film Borat for targeting small-time anti-Semitism, and then listed what he saw as more menacing instances of anti-Semitism. Among them, a Chavez quote saying that, quote, descendants of the same ones that crucified Christ, close quote, have, quote, taken possession of all the wealth of the world, close quote. But that supposed slur was debunked by Fair last January when the quotes first circulated. As Fair pointed out, Chavez's reference also included the descendants of those who expelled Bolivar from Venezuela as being among those representing, quote, less than 10% of the world population who own more than half of the riches of the world, close quote. Chavez was obviously referring generically to the wealthy and powerful, but by Krauthammer's reading, one would conclude that Chavez thinks Jews persecuted Simon Bolivar and account for 600 million of the world's population. At the time, American rabbi Arthur Waskow defended Chavez, telling the Associated Press, quote, I know of no one who accuses the Jews of fighting against Bolivar, close quote. And Fair's Alert noted that the Confederation of Jewish Associations of Venezuela was joined by the American Jewish Committee and the American Jewish Congress in pointing out that Chavez was not referring to Jews in his speech. So this would appear to be another case in which a Washington Post columnist believes he is entitled to not just his own opinions, but also his own facts.
Lawrence Kaplan starts off his November 27th column for the New Republic, making a point about how, with news outlets shuttering their Baghdad bureaus, Americans are getting less direct news from Iraq, leaving them to color what facts they do get with their imagination. Quote, or worse, to let Frank Rich or Rush Limbaugh or a pisher with a website do the coloring for them, close quote. Relying on Kaplan, however, could lead to important misunderstandings as well. His column, The Troops and Us, argues that for most Americans, Iraq is just an abstraction, and that their groundless chatterings are worlds away from the views of the U.S. military personnel serving there. Kaplan enjoins readers, for the sake of American soldiers, quote, who speak with a sense of ownership about their war and see themselves as a progressive force on the Iraqi landscape, and who, according to surveys by the Military Times and the Pew Research Center, hold opinions on the war that run almost exactly counter to those registered at home, be grateful that the machinery of war overwhelms the din from Washington. Close quote. While there may be something to be said about a disconnect between those who know what's happening in Iraq and those who don't, but this isn't it. Kaplan might well refer to the nitpicker blogger as a pisher with a website, but he did take the time to do what the New Republic evidently didn't, which was check those military polls Kaplan refers to. It turns out the Military Times hasn't conducted a poll for over a year, and the last one, which the group underscored did not represent the whole military, showed just a 10-point higher approval rate for the war than among the general U.S. population. As for Pew Research Center, they told Nitpicker that Kaplan simply had it wrong. They hadn't done a survey of military personnel on their opinions of the war. The only groups the blogger could find that had done such a survey, Zogby and Lemoyne College, have found most recently that nearly three-quarters of the troops in Iraq felt that the U.S. should leave the country within a year at the latest.
There's plenty going on in Afghanistan, a massive increase in NATO aerial bombing, civilian deaths, increased violence and suicide bombings, and a booming opium trade. The fact that few news outlets still have reporters in the country means the American public remains mostly unaware of these developments. So when a major network sends a correspondent to Afghanistan, it would seem a natural opportunity to get a handle on a largely forgotten war. But NBC didn't seem to think so. NBC Nightly News correspondent Jim Maceda's November 26th dispatch skipped over the ongoing violence in that country. That was quickly summarized by anchor John Siegenthaler. In order to present a warm, upbeat story about American soldiers winning the battle for local support. Maceda profiled one soldier who, quote, has never met an Afghan child he hasn't waved to, smiled at, or high-fived, close quote. If that sounds like NBC's missing the point, if not the real story, just consider Maceda's other report from Afghanistan just a few days earlier. The subject, Operation Hot Turkey, Thanksgiving dinner for U.S. soldiers.
With the new Democratic Congress promising to let the Medicare prescription drug program negotiate lower prices from drug companies, those companies have gotten their friends in the media to find some reason, any reason, why this would be a bad idea. The Washington Post, happy to defend corporate profits, declared in the lead paragraph of a front-page November 26th article that Democrats were in danger of, quote, wrecking a program that has proven cheaper and more popular than anyone imagined, unquote. Cheaper than anyone imagined? Only if that anyone doesn't include the White House itself, which once imagined that the 10-year cost of the program would be less than $400 billion. The latest 10-year estimate, $678 billion. It's true that the projected cost for 2006 was reduced significantly, but the biggest reason for this cost reduction was that far fewer people than expected signed up for the plan. But wait, isn't it more popular than anyone imagined? On that point, the Post article cited polls saying that more than 80% of enrollees are satisfied. But those questions were about whether they were satisfied with the plan they'd chosen under the program, not how happy they were with the program itself. A Wall Street Journal Harris poll released November 20th, for example, found 75% of enrollees were satisfied with their plan, but only 59% gave a positive rating to the program. And those who enroll, of course, are more positive than those who are eligible but don't enroll. Among all people over 65, only 47% give the Medicare drug program positive marks. When you create a program costing hundreds of billions of dollars to benefit a particular group, you might think that more than half of that group ought to be happy with the results. If they're not, then is an effort to change the program really cause for a page one alarm about wrecking it?
In a recent FAIR study of PBS's NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, sources who preferred to stay the course in Iraq outnumbered those who favored withdrawal by more than 5-1. That disparity was striking, especially when polls showed a greater percentage of the public favoring withdrawal than staying the course. That was months ago, and times have changed. The midterm election swept Democrats into power on what nearly all observers saw as a resounding vote against the Iraq war. So how is the NewsHour covering the debate over Iraq policy now? On November 20th, host Jim Lehrer presented what he called, quote, our own version of the debate, two men who've advised President Bush on Iraq policy this year, close quote. Two Bush advisors squaring off. That could be a debate, but neither of the guests, Fred Kagan of the right-wing American Enterprise Institute or Michael Vickers of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, advocated withdrawal. Kagan favored troop increases, while Vickers mostly parried, saying we don't have enough troops to send more. As Lehrer seemed to say, this sort of narrow spectrum is exactly the kind of debate the NewsHour prefers. And for a public that favors troop withdrawals? Well, it seems they need to go somewhere other than public TV's flagship newscast to hear anything like their own views.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is one of the most contested issues for media watchers. Pro-Israel lobbying groups have successfully disciplined outlets that have reported the issue contrary to their wishes, and it's common to hear reporters and columnists say that there is no other single story that evokes such strong reactions. That would suggest, then, that the discussion of the issue that does make it into print or on the airwaves is severely limited, leaving important history, context, and solutions off the table. A new book by frequent Counterspin guest Ali Abu Nima outlines one such vision. The book is called One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. Ali Abu Nima, welcome back to Counterspin.
Thank you.
Now, your new book proposes an idea that is almost unmentionable in political and media circles, that the solution to this conflict lies in the creation of a single state. You've debated the Mideast for years in the media with reporters and cable news hosts. You know this terrain. To say this is an uphill battle, I think, is an understatement. What led you to this argument that you lay out in the book?
Well, actually, I have a feeling that there's a lot more support and interest in this solution than you would be led to believe. I think that there is this sort of blanket media conventional wisdom that is supported by what I call a multi-billion dollar peace process industry to make people believe that the only possible solution is the division, the partition of Palestine, Israel into separate states. And despite this massive investment in partition, no partition seems achievable. We seem further away from the creation of a Palestinian state, and Israel seems sort of less and less viable over time than ever before. But when I've gone out and talked to people over recent years, both Palestinians, Israelis, American Jews, and others who are interested, people are saying, well, what are the alternatives? Why are we stuck in this rut? And this book is an attempt to really break open that discussion.
Why don't we talk about it? Are we just too far down the road or the roadmap to look back?
When I look at the responses I've gotten when I've gone into the media to talk about this issue, I think there is a lot of interest. But one sort of standard counter you get is, oh, you're talking about the destruction of Israel. That's a standard tactic used to silence this discussion. Of course, I'm not talking about the destruction of Israel. I'm talking about how can we provide for a dignified life for all Israelis and all Palestinians who are already living in the same country. It's not talking about creating one country. It's talking about recognizing the reality that it's one country and redressing the injustices and inequalities that have made peace with justice so elusive. So one of the tactics that has been used to steer discussion away from this is to claim that anything other than a discussion of the two-state solution is tantamount to calling for the destruction of Israel. And that has effectively silenced a lot of people and scared them off looking at solutions. In the book, I try to explore other models, taking inspiration from Northern Ireland, from Belgium, from Canada, from other places that have had to deal with similar conflicts, and to stop treating Israelis and Palestinians as if they are so unique and so exceptional that, you know, we always have to treat them with kid gloves.
I wanted to ask you about that because there is this tendency, I think, you know, anti-Arab racism is certainly well established in the American media. That would seem to be a tremendous obstacle. It fosters this notion that, sure, people can live together in peace, but Arabs are different. There's something about this story that makes it, and this conflict that makes it different than South Africa, different than certainly Ireland.
I examine that in the book. And with respect to South Africa, it's interesting that the arguments that were made against democracy in South Africa were the same. They were always this racialized discourse, this civilizational discourse, like, oh, you Europeans can lecture us whites in South Africa about democracy, but you don't know what it's like here. The people here are different. They are less civilized. They would slaughter us the minute they got their hands on the levers of power. The same is true in Northern Ireland, where the discourse that was used to justify very discriminatory measures against the Catholic nationalist population in Northern Ireland was the same. It was always about a civilizational, racialized discourse. And this is no different. People in power always justify their power by having some sort of superior claim. And what I examine in the book and try to learn the lessons from is how that changed in South Africa, how they were able to get beyond that.
Near the end of the book, you cited New York Times columnist Tom Friedman. He was reacting to the construction of this wall in the West Bank. He called for a quick two-state solution. He seemed to fear that otherwise there would be a movement among Palestinians and others to favor a single state approach. What would that single state look like? Is there anything to fear, as Friedman seemed to wonder?
Well, there is something to fear if your interest is to preserve an unjust monopoly on economic, military, and political power that the Israeli Jewish people currently hold. If the goal is to afford a dignified life for all the people in the country, to say, as I say in the book, Palestine, Israel belongs to all who live in it, which includes Israeli Jews and Palestinians and all the other peoples who live in it, because it is and has always been a very diverse, multi-ethnic, multi-religious society, then I think there's nothing to fear. Does that mean it's easy? No, of course not. A group giving up power always has fear that the tables will be turned on them. And that's why I focus a lot on examining how in South Africa and in other countries mechanisms were put in place. What was the process of negotiation? What had to change in the way people thought about the other for them not to have those sort of fears and to feel that they could go forward into a more hopeful future?
You mention at the end of the book there is this debate, very tentative one perhaps, within Israeli and Palestinian circles to talk about this. The next step, you say, should be to amplify this debate. One place to do that, of course, is the media. Are you hopeful this can happen in the media, or do you think it's going to have to happen kind of outside that?
So far, it's mostly happened outside the media, and I've been very, very excited by the reaction I've gotten going around and just talking to people about the book and talking to Palestinians, talking to Israelis, talking to others in the country. A lot of people say to me, why isn't this being talked about in the media? Why isn't it being talked about by politicians? So I think that it's sort of out there in the country that this will happen first. But I'm hopeful it will happen in the media too. I think that this issue has reached such a dead end. I think there is the beginnings of a clamor for a new way to talk about it. So I'm not at all pessimistic. As difficult as it is, I'm certainly not going to give up trying to have this discussion in the media.
We've been speaking with Ali Abu Nima. He is the co-creator and editor of Electronic Intifada and Electronic Iraq. His new book, One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse, is out now from Metropolitan Books. Ali Abu Nima, thanks for joining us on Counterspin.
It's my pleasure.
As Iraq sinks even further into bloodshed, war makers and their media supporters are looking for scapegoats, someone to blame for the catastrophe. In the media, for instance, Bill O'Reilly, a super hawk who predicted the war would be over in a matter of weeks, blames the Iraqis. Quote, "The problem in Iraq is not American. The problem is the Iraqis themselves. They're not fighting for their freedom. There is only so much the USA can do," close quote. But the crude, factually challenged Fox anchor is just one of many among U.S. political and media elites pointing fingers at everyone but those who launched and promoted the war. Gary Young, the New York correspondent for London's Guardian newspaper and a columnist for The Nation magazine, has been observing this phenomenon, writing in a November 27th Guardian column, quote, "Those who lied their way into this war are now trying to lie their way out," close quote. Gary Young joins us now by phone. Gary Young, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks very much for having me.
A November 29th Washington Post report begins, quote, "From troops on the ground to members of Congress, Americans increasingly blame the continuing violence and destruction in Iraq on the people most affected by it, the Iraqis," close quote. The recently released Hadley memo, where Stephen Hadley, the National Security Advisor, lists the perceived faults of Iraq Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, seems to be a variation on this same theme. Gary Young, is this what you mean when you write those who lied their way into this war are now trying to lie their way out?
In part, yes. I mean, first of all, everybody has to take responsibility for what they do. We can't ignore the fact that Iraqis are the people who are pulling the trigger most commonly on Iraqis at the moment. That said, the reason that Iraq is in the situation as it is because of the invasion. And there is a sense that kind of what the left wants to do is to keep rubbing people's faces in the fact that they'd like to, you know, to go to war, and let's all just move on and deal with the way it is. But actually, you can't solve this situation unless you understand the problem, and the problem is the invasion. So if you don't accept that the invasion was the problem, then you have to look somewhere else. And so they start now to blame the victim. And they do that without any sense of how does a country which has had its entire army disbanded, its entire civil service disbanded, is under occupation, how does that society then fight for anything? How does it kind of even exist in some kind of coherent space? How does this civil society assert itself? Of course it doesn't, notwithstanding the fact that's after decades of dictatorship, 3 years of occupation, and years of colonialism and monarchy before that. So the reason that Iraq is in this situation is because of the invasion. And it's not that the Iraqis aren't ready for democracy. They were never ready for invasion.
So in precisely what sense is blaming Iraq or al-Maliki lying?
It's refusing to take responsibility for what the West has done. It suggests that al-Maliki has more power than in fact he does. America runs Iraq. Al-Maliki really doesn't. And it says that the original problem is not the invasion. It's not that there's an occupying force. It's that the Iraqis aren't ready for prime time. The way that it's lying is that it chooses a reason for the failure in Iraq that actually has nothing to do with why things are failing in Iraq. And so it absolves the West of any responsibility for what they've done.
In your Guardian column, you note that this finger-pointing in the U.S. is not limited to Republicans, and you cite incoming Democratic congressional whip Steny Hoyer blaming Iraqis for the situation they're in. Well, in the same theme of finger-pointing, fairly crude demonization is often a part of war, and you've noted some renewed efforts of that sort recently on the cover of Newsweek magazine.
Well, yeah, it's the whole enemy of the month club thing. There was the long-lost and long-forgotten Osama bin Laden, and then there was Saddam Hussein, and then there was this pack of 55 cards, and then it was Zarqawi. Each person that they kill, it really doesn't seem to capture, it doesn't really seem to make much difference what's going on the ground. And now it's Muqtada al-Sadr. The picture of him on Newsweek has him looking as much like a demon as a man possibly could without, you know, the horns and the trident. The issue here is not whether Muqtada al-Sadr is a good person or a bad person or whether one supports him or not. In terms of the political reality on the ground in Iraq, it is fairly clear that Muqtada al-Sadr is a key player. And so one needs to understand him. And we don't get to understand him any better if we dress him up as the enemy of this month. that doesn't help kind of understand what's going on the ground in Iraq.
To read U.S. press, some sort of miraculous solution may come from a man ingenuously being called Mr. Fix-It, James Baker, in the Iraq Study Group. As we speak on November 30th, the story is broken. They've leaked the details of what the Iraq Study Group's recommendations are. What do you make of the coverage of this?
One thing I think is interesting about the coverage of it is that it's rarely pointed out that the fact that this study group was necessary itself highlights a flaw, I think, in American politics, that democracy should have been able to deal with this, not an appointed commission. Had there been oversight in Congress, that should have been the Iraq Study Group. Congress, to me, has been about managing expectations. And so it's been kind of covered in terms of leaks and, you know, little glimpses of what they might do. And I think, and to this extent, it's been covered kind of, this has been covered fairly reasonably. This is presented as some kind of face-saving device, which I think it is, for some way of the Bush administration climbing down from its current position. What's really been peculiar is that this has happened simultaneously alongside Bush's continued assertion that nothing's going to change, we're going to stay the course, and so on. So it looks like there's going to be a more conflict down the pike between Bush and this group.
Well, we're running out of time, but on the subject of the lack of public discussion and debate, I wanted to ask you, what are some of the biggest differences you've noted between U.S. coverage and that in the rest of the world, and mainly in Great Britain?
Well, let's talk about Britain. Britain has the peculiar and disingenuous comfort, British people, of blaming much of this on the Bush administration. Disingenuous because, of course, Britain completely enabled the Bush administration. They were the people who gave their drunk friend the car keys and said, you know, you go ahead and, you know, have a safe trip home. And so there is a degree of smugness in that. But that otherwise, there is a gradual unraveling. There is a sense of an unraveling and a distancing. And so Britain has been talking about, you know, when it's going to withdraw. And there is a sense of America really being on its own now, more and more. And that's certainly true from the British coverage. It's no longer like, what are we going to do about this? And it's more like, what's Bush going to do about this? And that is, to some extent, aided by the fact that the areas that Britain occupies are not the most contentious areas. And so there's been more of a sense in recent months that this is an internal problem for the U.S. to deal with. As far as international wars go, there's been lots more concern and coverage, not more than Iraq, but more than there has been about Afghanistan.
We've been speaking with Gary Young, New York correspondent for the Guardian newspaper of London and columnist for The Nation magazine. Gary Young, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure and tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. The time is now 6 o'clock. Stay tuned for Bread and Roses. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from, in other words, Women's Books and Resources, serving you from its new location at 8 Northeast Killingsworth at Williams. In other words, is your local, nonprofit, feminist bookstore and resource center offering community space, gifts, tools for the revolution, women's writings, and much more. 503-232-6003 or inotherwords.org. And now, Bread and Roses.
Their ancient wisdom flowing, they will lend a loving ear. They will lend a loving ear. First they'll form a loving circle around the wounded wing, then contain the brutal beasts of war. Sweet freedom songs they'll sing.
Hello, and welcome to Bread and Roses. I'm Crystal, and I have some wonderful guests for us tonight, the Raging Grannies. Welcome, Grannies.
Hello.
Hi.
Let's just go around the circle, and I'm going to start on my right. And if you would just introduce yourself, say a few words, we'll have more chances to talk, but just an introduction to our listeners now.
Hi, my name is Georgia Pinkle. And I live in Vancouver, Washington.
You're kind of the beginner of this gaggle, aren't you?
One of the founding members, yes.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm Mary Rose. I'm sitting next to Georgia, and I live here in Portland.
I'm Jan, and I live in Vancouver.
I'm Yvonne, and I live in Portland.
So we come by our name, the Columbia River Raging Grannies, honestly. Spanning both sides of the river.
And I didn't even have your right name, so I'm sorry. Welcome. Say it again.
Columbia River.
Columbia River, Raging Grannies. Oh, all right. Well, I'm so glad to have you here tonight. And it just seemed to me doing the first Bread and Roses program in December, which has always struck me as a kind of celebratory holiday from the beginning to the end. There are so many different peoples and different groups that have spiritual connections in this month, and it just seemed to me that the Raging Grannies needed to be here to begin the month off with us. And our Leanne, our nowhere near a grandmother, is helping us get set up. Is everything all right?
Let's we should tell you, Crystal, that being a raging granny is a state of mind more than age. And we call ourselves a gaggle rather than a gang.
Oh, I like gaggle. I like gaggle. Honoring the bird spirit.
I guess.
Well, so in this gaggle, how long have you folks who are here tonight? I know your group is bigger at times and smaller than that times, but how long have you've been doing this together?
We came together, it's been close to 4 or 5 years now, coming out of my experience, at least in Seattle with the WTO. I actually saw the Seattle Raging Grannies perform that Wednesday, which was a Women's Day. And then we had several of them come down and do a workshop at Clark College's Women's Conference.
Mm.
And it started from there.
Wonderful. And so you were there. And Mary Rose, you've sung in Portland for a long time, haven't you?
Well, yes, it's been longer than I like to admit to anymore. But as long as I have a voice and sometimes it helps to have the guitar, so I was a little reluctant to join the Grannies at first because I thought, well, it's all derivative, you know. They're just singing songs that everybody knows. At least we know the tunes of them, but the words are different. And it turned out that there were two things that just decided me I should belong, and one was the fact that we can wear comfortable clothes. We don't have to wear a uniform. And I always wear comfortable clothes anymore. And the other thing was that we can say something in a politically progressive way, and I think it goes over a lot better because it's got humor in it than a lot of speeches do. So I felt it was really mandatory that I go along with the Raging Grannies.
Oh, I think that was said beautifully. I think that humor and music and some of the other special qualities that grandmothers have a lot to do with the success of what I see the tide turning now. I don't know if you'd all agree, but we can talk about that later. But now, can you hear? Are your
yes?
Okay, great. Why don't you say a little bit about how you came to be part of this group?
Well, I only joined about a little over a year ago. Was it 2 years now? Maybe 2 years. And I joined because I really was desperately needing a place to sing because I had recently stopped being a member of Aurora Chorus, which I had loved for many years, and really was feeling a loss in my life of not having a place to sing. And I really liked the Raging Grannies because it was a way to sing political songs. And so that was my reason for joining.
Glad that you did. I can't hear myself, but I assume that I'm on. And so let's go to our fourth member of this group now, a little bit about how you came to be with them.
By accident.
A fortunate accident, I presume.
And I love wearing those big old-fashioned hats with flowers on and scarves and the colors and... well, actually, I've sang a long time. Well, I've sang in Portland with Mary Rose for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many years. I can't remember. And I really felt that I was so involved with so many things. I love what the Raging Grannies did. It's just the time during the practicing and everything. And so what happened is that I would be around when they were singing, and there wasn't enough to sing. They said, "Well, why don't you join us?" And that's really how I got involved with Raging Grannies. And I don't know how long it's been that, well, come on and join us for...
But you were at the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
And it all clicked. Isn't that great? Do you think as grandmothers, or I'll say women of a grandmother's age at least, that one tends to be a little more tuned into those synchronicities that happen, that bring people toward each other? Any thoughts or opinions?
Well, I think crones have a special place in our society, which is not really recognized.
No.
But we have the time to see the big picture, look towards the future, and do some evaluating about what's going on. You talked about, you know, the change in the wind, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Last night I was over at the Portland City Council, and they passed a resolution which would bring the troops home. I mean, they're getting on record.
They did it.
They actually did it unanimously. A lot of testifying. And it seemed to me there was only two mentions of women. And I think we need to attack the root cause of what we're in now. And a lot of it is there aren't any women at the table when these discussions take place. We're left out. And
yes.
So the hyper-masculinity takes over. The bully boy seems to be a model that's acceptable. And if the mothers and the grandmothers were at the table, I think things would be different, and they would have changed a lot sooner.
It would have been a different table, wouldn't it, one that served compassion and not obedience to the...
Or profit.
Or profit.
Well, I think, too, with age comes a sense of the past. We know what has happened in the past, and most of us remember quite a bit. And I think that enhances my
attitude about what's going on now. I remember when things were pretty bad and we didn't have justice and freedoms that we want. And I think that that helps me to put it in perspective, because I remember how things mm-hmm. have been in the past, sometimes not so good and sometimes perhaps a little bit better.
I think that's a wonderful thing that you're mentioning. We have our memories. We've seen things happen, tragedies, traumas, the few wonderful things sprinkled therein. But in the, for the most part, we've seen what goes wrong, and we have some.
I also think that we also know youth. You know, I was thinking of my last birthday. I thought, well, yeah, my body's older, but my mind isn't. And I remember the first time I was singing political songs was when I was 14, and I was in England, and it was on the three-day march on the Aldermaster March. And I still know those songs now, now I'm still singing them, and some of them are the same. And it's just, you know, it's just wonderful to. And I think that we really have so much in common, and so much. That we are doing as the younger people are doing, but we're doing it in an older body, and that older body has an older mind. Although the mind is young, it kind of has all these little secret doors in it that open up and it opens up, and some wisdom, I hope, comes out.
Yes, some bit of wisdom comes out. Well, are you ready to do another song at this point? I'll ask all four of you because...
Sure, we're ready.
Sure.
Sure.
Okay, and Leanne out there and Molly, we're going to do that live now.
No more war. Whether it's Bin Laden or Saddam Hussein, war is not the answer. Bombs just kill and maim. So join this gaggle of grannies. Get up off of your fannies. We're telling you now.
Another one?
Oh, I hope you will. Are you ready to do another one right away?
Yeah, let's give a home where the rivers don't foam. We've organized these pretty much. Georgia has organized these songs to show the extent and the range of our political awareness. So give me a home where the rivers don't foam. And these words are pretty much sent to us by different members sometimes. We change them a little bit. The tunes are usually familiar, but the words are pointed, so we hope you enjoy them.
Can eat from your dish, and the skies are not smoggy and gray. Home, home on the earth, her beauty's beginning to fade. We've got to act fast, our luck just won't last, our world we can't just toss away. Those nuclear wastes are inclined to escape after it. ground they are dumped. We don't want PCBs in the birds and the bees and dioxins on our babies' rums. Beauty's beginning to fade. We've got to act fast. Our luck just won't last. Our world we can't just toss away. Oh, give me a home safe inside the ozone, 'cause there's danger in those cosmic rays. Oceans up to our necks from the greenhouse effect. Please don't wash the beauty away.
Join us, Crystal.
Home, home on the earth. Her beauty's beginning to fade. We've got to act fast. Our luck just won't last. Our world we can't just toss away.
Oh, what fun you folks are. I love those words.
So we have some that are a little more pointed. This next one, if you'll let us do it, is called The Battle Hymn of the Republicans.
Ooh, you couldn't stop me.
Familiar tune again. Okay.
Mine eyes have seen the bungling of that stumbling moron Bush. He has blathered all the drivel that the neocons can push. He has lost sight of all reason, 'cause his head is up his tush. The doofus marches on. I
Let's start that second verse.
I have heard him butcher syntax like a kindergarten fool. There is warranted suspicion that he never went to school. Should we fault him for the policies, or is he just their tool? The lies keep piling on.
Ready.
Glory, glory, how he'll screw. Glory, glory, how he'll screw ya. Glory, glory, how he'll screw ya. His wreckage will live on. I have seen him cut the taxes of the billionaire's lone heir as he spends another zillion on an aircraft carrier. Let the smokestacks keep polluting. Do we really need clean air? The surplus is now gone. Glory, glory, how he'll screw ya. Glory, glory, how he'll screw ya. Glory, glory, how he'll screw ya. His safety net is gone. Now he's got a mighty hanker into bomb a prostrate state. Though the whole world knows he's crazy and the UN said to wait. When he doesn't have the evidence, we must prevaricate. Diplomacy is gone. Oh, a trumped up war is excellent. We have no moral bounds. Should the reasons be disputed, we'll just make up other grounds. Enraging several billions to his brainlessness rebounds. The doofus marches on. Glory, glory, how he'll screw ya. Glory, glory, how he'll screw ya. Glory, glory, how he'll screw.
Of course, we sing that to selected audiences.
I gotta tell you, live here on KBOO 90.7 FM, you heard it tonight, live and in person, the Columbia River Raging Grannies. And they are singing us awake. I think that's really what you folks do. I mean, who could not hear this and pay attention?
I think that's the justice position. Yes, the old tunes everybody knows, but with the new words. And they end up sticking in your brain, too.
Yeah. Yes. So who wrote this? All of you together? How did that process
work? No, actually, we don't have a lyricist in our group, but many of the gaggles around the country and around the world, for that matter, do have people that this is their joy, this is what they like to do. So we share them over the Internet. Actually, they have a printed songbook, which is available.
And how might people get, oh, yes, I'm looking at it now, the Raging Grannies songbook.
Again, I got mine from the Seattle Raging Grannies, but actually you could go to the WILF website. That's Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. So it's www.wilpf.org, and it's rather inexpensive coming from our national office. And it's a collection of songs, again, arranged by topic or issue.
Yes, I'm just reading here. The Raging Grannies Songbook contains over 100 of the Grannies' best-loved peace, environmental, anti-war, and anti-war toys, also songs, including such classics as This Can Is Your Can.
That's a recycled one.
That's a recycled one.
And you have to remember, some of these we do have to adapt because the Grannies originated in Canada, actually in Vancouver, B.C.
Yes, and they did quite a few political actions with their parliament there, as I recall reading.
They're really very adventuresome. They have gone and attempted to inspect the Trident missile base. They have knitted a tank to the ground.
They knitted a tank?
Well, they knitted the ropes that would tie it down.
Oh, how lovely.
They went out in canoes in the Sound and corralled a submarine kind of thing.
Really?
Yeah, and it's very difficult for the police to arrest grannies, although since 9/11 it's not been as difficult as the New York grannies did get arrested. The Tucson grannies got arrested for trespassing.
Those were thrown out of the court, though, weren't they?
They just don't learn.
They got arrested because they wanted to enlist and go over to Iraq. And
that's right, yeah.
To. Yeah, that's
yeah,
why.
Yeah. It's amazing.
And they wanted to sing them songs.
And too. I think we're still on the FBI surveillance list.
Oh, yes. Oh, we're on the cover of the Washington State ACLU as being on the FBI watch list.
The
Seattle Grannies, yes.
That's
yes.
Great. That's
we're in good company.
I am looking at a beautiful black and white picture here of quite a large group of women with beautiful hats. I got to say, beautiful hats.
Hats and aprons.
And aprons.
Lots of pins. We wear pins, you know, our Ban the Bomb pins or whatever we've got.
Yes, yes. I met a wonderful woman from New York who makes lovely pins.
Oh, really?
Yes, I probably should connect you two up with each other. I'm sure she'd like to make pins for your group.
So the grannies, again, being originating in Canada, it's starting to drift down into the U.S., but around the world as well. If you Google grannies, they show up in England and in Germany, and I believe in Japan.
In Israel.
In Israel.
That would be wonderful. I'd like to see some grannies talking in Israel.
Yeah.
They're very strong in California.
Mm-hmm. Some have associated themselves with WILF branches, but it's not required.
I was going to ask you about that connection. Maybe you could tell us, because I Googled a little bit in my technophobic way, but I didn't get what you're talking about. Anyway, about the Women's International...
Oh, WILF?
WILF, yes.
Women's International League for Peace and Freedom is the oldest continuously meeting women's international women's peace organization. Started in 1915 as they attempted to stop World War I.
We welcome men as members, too.
Yes, we do.
And they may make donations, possibly?
Of course.
All right. Just
also, in 1915... we had a Canton principal went over on a boat to The Hague in Europe, where the women met, and some women came from the war zone, so it was very difficult for them to get there. And Grace DeGraff, she was the only woman west of the Mississippi to go. So we have one of the first Wilfers here from here.
Yeah, amazing work. And we've been at it ever since, trying to find alternatives to actual armed conflict. The culture changes slowly. But the men aren't listening to the women. They need to listen to the women for a change.
Well, that's what I think. I feel a rising surge of women of all ages coming to that realization that the patriarchy as it stands now is not helping anybody but the very rich patriarchs. And it is time for women's voices to be heard. And I'm so glad that you women are committed to doing this work. Where are you going to be next? Do you have any special plans coming for places people can hear you?
Well, the next one that we know of is tentatively set for December 16th at the Democratic Women's Holiday Luncheon over in Vancouver.
Great.
But we are available for events, meetings. We work cheap. Chocolate is always accepted.
Oh, I knew I forgot to bring the chocolate tonight. Alas, too bad.
But we also, our contact info, I'll go ahead and give mine. Email is gpinkel, P-I-N-K-E-L, @pacifier.com, where you can reach me at the Wilf office here in Portland, 503-224-5190, and leave a message. We are accepting members from both sides of the river. Although we practice currently in Vancouver, we can arrange to do some... Ah, chocolate is arriving.
Annalisa!
Yay!
All right. The news and public affairs.
Phone number? Okay.
I was also going to say that you do not need to be an accomplished musician. It would be nice if you could carry a tune, but even that's not required.
No, we have no audition. We have no requirements. As I say, it's a state of mind. If you think you're a raging granny, you are a raging granny. If you would care to jump up on stage whenever you see us, we welcome that as well. And we have done that. We have conscripted people at events, and they have a great time. We have a great time. We enjoy our practicing, and we enjoy our performing.
And you're saying you're pretty interactive with the group that you're performing for, too, it sounds like, which is so important.
Yeah.
And we sing in the street, too, like buskers.
Wonderful.
Well, we've done a little bit of anti-recruiting, and we may be doing a little bit more of that. And actually, I think we should be also supporting some of the Jobs with Justice and the labor issues.
So there are so many wonderful groups on both sides of the river that are supporting change, major change, and I guess it's important for you to know about them and them to know about you, and I think they probably everybody does, but it's good to know that you're out there. You can come for some of the events that happen, rallies and such. Well, okay, I'll ask you, because you're the ones who are here performing. Should we play another one of your songs, or would you like to... Can you sing some more tonight? I say can, because I don't want to...
Yes,
we're always ready to sing.
We don't have to ask. Well, ladies, I think we'd all be ready for that.
This is this next one is a little newer, from the prisons of Guantanamo.
From the prisons of Guantanamo to the cities of Iraq, how we fight the war on terror makes the terrorists fight back. First we bomb their land to smithereens, saying it's just quid pro quo. Then we take men from their houses. Then we torture and humiliate, saying they are not like me. If we curbed our urge to escalate and we stopped this foolish strife, we could all go home to family and get back to living life.
Just a little reminder of what we're really in the world for.
Yes, indeed.
If you've got time for one more, this next one is a little different. Peace in the world. A little...
You know, we've got lots of time, I'm happy to say.
Oh, very good.
And so we can talk and sing.
This is a change of pace, just a gentle reminder.
Ready?
Lives were lost, the country damaged, terror unfurled. Revenge and blame will never get us peace in the world. While the nations grieve in sorrow, together we will face tomorrow. Combine our strength and join our call for peace in the world. Women work with determination for peace in the world. Tell our leaders and our nations peace in the world. Peace in the world.
Nice lullaby.
Very nice. Very nice. So you have many songs in your repertoire.
Actually, we do pretty well, and we try to be as diverse as the issues that we're concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
I think if anything lacks a lot, oddly enough, it's women. We only have a few women songs honoring women. So we need to work on gathering a few more, I think.
We just assume that if we have the gall to stand up there and sing these songs, we'll be honored for it.
We know how that works.
All right.
We do have Listen to the Women for a Change.
Yeah, we'll end with that one.
Oh, yes. So you have some of that one. That's wonderful. Well, I was in Washington, D.C. for the Mother's Day Peace Rally, and there was a group there called Emma's Revolution, three young women from the East Coast who hopefully will eventually work their way to this coast too, and I think it would be great if they could meet you. So if I hear more about them, maybe
Emma's Revolution?
Emma's Revolution. Yeah.
I'll try Googling that. That's great.
Well, so I'd also like to hear a little bit about your families, how that works. I imagine being grandmothers or the age of grandmothers, I find as I'm getting older and ready for Social Security, whatever that's going to mean, and all, I do have more time for myself. And I'm kind of guessing that is one of the reasons that led each of you to put your energies out away from home now.
Yeah, I think I found when I stopped working and I was forced into retirement, as
many are,
for a lot of different reasons, I needed to fill my time with work that was meaningful. And it's amazing, there's a lot of work out there. Of course, it's not being paid, no one's organizing it, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done for our communities, for our schools, for our children, for our elderly. You know, and I'm one of the young elderly, if you want to think of it that way. Mm-hmm. So we have the freedom to meet in the daytime for our practicing and events.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my family is Nutmeg, Gremlin, and Cholito. Two cats and a dog, and the dog was born in a hole in the ground in Lima, Peru, where I work with children and women on a garbage dump. And then my family is my brothers and sisters who work for peace and freedom and for human rights.
A family of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big family.
Big
large
family. Yeah.
Well, I am childless, so I'm not an actual grandmother, and I still think I'm too young for this group, though the calendar tells me otherwise. But I've been politically active all my life, and for the last 15 years, I've had a lot more free time because I was not working and got involved in a lot of different causes, and this is just an extension of that.
Mm-hmm. So you've been.
And speaking of causes, I would like to say that it would be very apropos to also recognize that today is World AIDS Day.
Yes,
and
thank you.
That affects a lot of women and is becoming the leading cause of death. Actually, has become the leading cause of death for women in the United States between ages 25 and 44. And it's really still at epidemic proportions worldwide. And so I would like that not to be overlooked today, because I think that's really important that we remember that.
Yeah. I'm really glad you mentioned that. Could you give that statistic again? Because I believe you, but I think it's going to amaze people.
In the black community, actually, I probably ought to preface that, because that in the black community,
in
the United States, the leading cause of death for women between age 25 and 44 is now AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And worldwide, that's the case for women of all colors.
Yes.
The epidemic has not abated, and so I think we really need to keep reminding people about that, and it affects all ages. You don't ever outgrow the risks.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you're sexually active, that it will be a risk.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm glad that you mentioned that today.
It's not just safe sex anymore. It's bigger than that. It's wider than the personal anymore. So thanks, Jan. I'm glad you said that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, and I know that Kabu talked some about this, but I don't know how many people today understood it to be International AIDS Awareness Day. Is that correct?
Well, yes. Actually, I used to be part of the Bread and Roses Collective. And,
you're the one.
And I always had a show about AIDS on December 1st when I was doing the shows.
Is that right?
Just as a way to get people to learn more about the issues.
Well, there's another synchronicity that I just really love. I love it when history repeats itself in good ways. Heavens knows with Bush out there and others, we're repeating history in bad ways. But, that's very good to hear. When were you part of Bread and Roses? Do you remember?
It's at least five. I did it for about 5 years, and it's been at least 5 years since then, I think, that I stopped doing that.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I came here about 45 years ago, too, or came probably just as you were leaving. Well, have you spoken yet, Mary Rose, on the about being a grandmother or being of the age of a grandmother?
Well, it's more important to me to be a member of the community than being a grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
I have many friends who have chosen not to have children, and I think that we give lip service to this mothering business, but I think that it's the wider community that I identify with, one of peace, and anti-war, and personal health, and things like that, and saving the world from ourselves, whatever I can do that's important to me, and that's my family now. I do have people that I respect because they are closer to me when they were very young, but I really think that my family now is the wider community that I work with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I use the word grandmothers, and I'm not one yet. I could be theoretically, but my son and his wife have not chosen to go that route yet. But no, I think that I think of grandmothers in terms of women who have lived life and who have wisdom gained in that living to pass on to others, who are natural teachers and natural nurturers. And I don't think it has so much to do with the physical giving of birth, but certainly the spiritual giving of birth that that I think all of the arts echo in some way, and certainly your music, your humorous music that lightens hearts and gives hopes is the kind of energy that I'm enjoying from you.
Thank you.
Anything, there's so many things we could talk about, and I'd like it if you sang some more, but what's your pleasure right now?
Let's do another song. We have one that Yvonne and I have sung together for many years called Home in the Sky. And this is a song by Nancy Schimmel, who is the daughter of Malvina Reynolds.
Oh,
and
yes.
So this is historical, too. And this is such a beautiful song. When we sing it for children, they all recognize some of the words like habitat and species. And there are some other things that you'll hear. And those who are musical historians will perhaps get the resonance of classic American country songs that comes through these words.
Is there a habitat in heaven for the species that no longer dwell? I would like to think the dodo has a birth. We have cut down the wild wood, the sweet waters blessed. It must be the eighth deadly sin to tear up creation so the birds have no nest. I only hope that God will take them in. I would like to take a walk with the great and little hawk. I would like to see the passenger pigeons fly. And all the feathered folk who have no home in this world, I hope they find a home in the sky. I hope they find a home. That are still to meet their doom. When earthly comfort fails for the elephants and whales, will the pastures of heaven give them room? Will the great condor glide over on the other side? Will I still hear the mountain lion roar? When we meet on that beautiful shore, will I watch the dolphins play in that home far away? Will I meet with a shy chimpanzee? from this earth, will there still be room in heaven for me? Will there still be room in heaven for you and me? Will there still be room in heaven for me? And if we kill so many of the creatures on this earth, will there still be room in heaven for me?
This is KBOO, and it's Bread and Roses, and you're listening to the live singing of the Raging Grannies, Columbia River chapter. Well, that was beautiful. Now, is that something that came from, how did that originate? That
actually, I think Mary Rose and Yvonne have recorded this song.
You have.
And so they shared it with us, and we just think it's appropriate when we do songs about ecology and the future that we need to consider. And actually, the interdependent web of life and our place in it as opposed to on it puts it all in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Nancy Schimmel is a member of Sisters Choice, which is in Berkeley, California, and they record songs that are appropriate for their political perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought this was one of their better songs. I really like it. I've always liked it.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And I do recognize it as some older song, which I couldn't put the actual name to.
Yes, and we have to remember the animals.
Oh, yes. Yes. It's just another one of our fellow beings, sister beings on the planet. Well, I wonder if PETA and other organizations have ever come to you to ask, or have you done any music for the
Animal rights.
Rescue.
I have. And Mary Rose, you have too, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and we did a fundraiser once in Portland. And,
did you?
Had different singers.
Uh-huh.
Oh, and we did one with...
Spay your pets.
What was that? Give Pets a Chance. We did one. We had some really good singers. That was a fundraiser because an animal needed care.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, you do hear stories often of abandoned, especially the larger animals, when people think they can take care of them and yet they end up not being able to. So that's another organization that you've supported. Wonderful.
I was going to bring up a reference. Back in 95 with the... Fourth World Conference on Women.
In Beijing. Yes,
right.
You went, didn't you?
I got to go, but also Wilf worked and put together a peace train that went from Helsinki, I believe, all the way across Europe and Asia.
You were there?
She wasn't on the train, but she was...
I wasn't on the train, though.
Right. But anyway, this is an article that was written up, and it talking about and singing about revolution, but one of the women said... She explained that singing is how women she knows collect and transmit information. And she says, I've found that people in the developed world do not sing much. And so I say that to me, development means losing your songs. Mm-hmm. And the person who gets developed stops singing. So we really need to think about our culture and where singing fits in. Often we do the cult of the famous the professional, and they're the only ones that get to sing. And so we really need to get back to the community singing, as you mentioned before, Aurora Chorus, the organized community singing, and the unorganized community singing that we kind of do.
Well, talking about 95 and Helsinki, it reminds me of, I had been under siege in Sarajevo at the time.
That's right.
And I got out just before, and I had hardly any money left, so I hitchhiked. And from Budapest, and I went very slowly, and it was raining, and I got to the capital of Poland, Warsaw,
and phoned Helsinki. They said, Yvonne, you're never going to make it. You've got river to cross. And it was starting the next day, so somebody sent me a ticket. But when I was under siege in Sarajevo, we used to sing a lot. And especially when there was terrible bombing, there used to be people that would just go in the toilet and sing because... And I would phone people and sing, how could anyone ever tell you that you're anything less than beautiful?
Oh.
And we translated it into Bosnian and sang. And it was people, because we used to do things with the elderly because they couldn't go out anywhere. And we would sing in Bosnian and they would sing their songs. And it was just wonderful because really there wasn't much to do.
You know, the idea of singing to the elderly, I think is wonderful because in my life I've experienced such a gift-giving back and forth between when I was a very young child, I was raised by my grandmother and her friends were all older and I had such a rich opportunity to just listen and to older women talk, and I think maybe that helped form who I became. But I think it's beautiful that you, in that day, we're giving to the elderly there in Sarajevo, and then you got yourself to China, and now you've gotten yourself here to Portland, and just spreading the music.
I like traveling.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's our worldwide traveler.
She's a world traveler. Well, you know, music is made for
traveling. Well, you learn a lot about peoples, and we're all the same. We just have different... we just have different foods, different clothes, different languages, different religions, but we all go to bed and wake up and have breakfast, or go to school or go to work. So, you know, I mean, everybody is basically the same, but it's really fascinating. You know, everybody is, you know, it's so interesting to learn about what different peoples do.
Oh, it must be wonderful. And, you know, I'm saying, I'll go ahead and say it. Are there very many raging grannies, though, I wonder, in the middle part of the country? They're on the West Coast and they're on the East Coast, and you know, I had married a man long ago from Kansas, and I just can't imagine
there is a Kansas
raging granny.
Yes, there is.
Ah, I feel like there is really hope out there.
Yes, it's spreading.
There's hope. There is hope.
There
as
is long as
hope.
We can keep singing, there's hope. It's the one thing that oppressive regimes can't stand is singing, particularly in opposition to whatever they're doing, and laughter, humor. They're not funny people. They take things too seriously.
Well, you know, if only there could have been some laughter sometimes that the resident has spoken. You know, why was it just silence? Or why couldn't it have been just hearty
uproar.
Laughter?
Uproar.
Surely you jest. You can't mean what
you're
doing.
You can't be serious.
No, where are you coming from?
Okay, they were looking for the contact info again.
Mm-hmm.
And for a phone number, I'm giving out the Wilf office phone. You can leave a message at 503-224-5190. We're going to be putting some information up on the local Portland Wilf website, and that's www.portland.wilf.org. And then my email, if you want to get in touch with me in particular, it's G for Georgia, G Pinkel, P-I-N-K-E-L, at pacifier, P-A-C-I-F-I-E-R, .com. And we've been practicing Monday, the first Monday of the month, over in Vancouver, and it's really is easy to get across the bridge. I can get you there.
And it's in the afternoon, so you don't have to drive at night.
That's right.
Well, I got to tell you, as somebody who commutes to back and forth, I live in Vancouver, too, and you want to be able to get off up there before 3 p.m.
That's right.
Or else have a nice bunch of people in your car for you, so you can drive
sing
the
along.
Fast one and sing along. Well, we're hearing that there's just a few minutes left, about 4 minutes left. Could there be another song?
We'll go ahead with right. Listen to the Women for a Change.
Listen to the women, hear our voices, study our lives and trust our choices. Say bed with a woman as she labors to give birth. Take her hand and promise her you'll work for life on earth. And listen to the women for a change. Listen to the women for a change. Listen to the women, hear our voices, study our lives and trust our choices. Listen to each woman as she tells of pain and hurt. Help her every way you can to work for peace on earth. And listen to the women for a change. Listen to the women for a change. Listen to the women, hear our voices, study our lives and trust our choices. Work with the women until all the wars have ceased. Sit her at the table to negotiate for peace. And we'll listen to the women for a change. Listen to the women for a change. Listen to the women, hear our voices, study our lives and trust our choices. Together we can work to stop the violence and hate. We want peace and justice now, no longer can we wait. And we'll listen to the women for a change. Listen to the women for a change.
Oh, beautiful, just beautiful. Well, I have enjoyed this hour enormously. I haven't had such fun in ages, and I hope you've enjoyed being here.
Oh, this has been delightful.
Thank you, Crystal. It's been a real treat to be here.
Oh, and thank you, Kevu, for
And I hope everybody out there enjoyed it, too.
Yes.
I hope so, too. We didn't invite any callers to call because we wanted to use the time for music, but hopefully, the people out there will call in for any information they need. Any last words anyone wants to say before we go out?
No, we're open to new members. Jump in. We'd like a large pool so that when we are called upon to sing, we'll have a core that'll be able to do it. Not everybody's schedule, you know, fits in. Mm-hmm. So we do invite you to get in touch and come to a practice even if you want to see how things go.
And you don't have to be a great singer, right?
No.
Because you all sound great, but some of us have to struggle for that.
We have several that their enthusiasm is what counts.
Oh, I love hearing
fun.
That.
And it's fun. And thank you for the chocolates.
Yes.
Oh, that was kindness of Annalise when yes. she just heard you needed chocolates. She was there. Well, I'm just going to thank the listeners for joining us tonight, and be sure to tune in next Friday for Bread and Roses. Your host next week will be Gabrielle Ross, and the topic is women and gambling addictions. This is Crystal Leedy, and thank you all for listening, and we'll say goodbye for now.
Goodbye.
Start all the armor on, should we make war? Must we start killing tons, they're unwilling to talk some more? Wake up, America, rise up, stop this hysteria, be mighty wary.
Been listening to Bread and Roses. This is KBOO 90.7 FM. The time is now 7 o'clock. And earlier we neglected to announce that Counterspin this evening was made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org.